Blog Talk Radio.
Paperback Writer.
Buddy, this is the Writer's Lounge, where we showcase new authors. This is show number 140, and I am Tom Riedel, your host, and it is July 10th, 2023, and our co-host, Terry Brown, will be with us shortly. Tonight on the Writer's Lounge, we have on Russell Johnson, who wrote Moonshine Messiah, and Russell will be with us at about 15 minutes after the hour. Now more about us. Here's where you can find us out there. Find us on Facebook, The Writer's Lounge, showcasing new authors. Find the book reviews of all of our current shows over at thomasriedel.net. That's thomasriedel.net in the blog section. And the on-demand radio shows can be found there on the podcast page as well. Or go over to the Blog Talk Radio site and search for The Writer's Lounge, or find us easily on a Google search. Find me on Twitter at TomRiedel56, and our email is writerslounge2020@yahoo.com. If you want to be a guest on the show and have your book reviewed, put guest request in the subject line and we will get back to you. Special note, we can now be heard on your Alexa device. Subscribe to Apple Podcasts and ask her to play The Writer's Lounge, showcasing new authors. I'd also like to put in a good plug for Goodreads and Readsy Discovery. They both do a great deal to help authors and readers alike, and I also review books on both sites as well. Upcoming authors on the Writer's Lounge in 2 weeks on July 24th, Tomasina Discrescenzo will be here with her Two Left Feet. That's the book she wrote. And it's about the voice of an 11-year-old girl living in 1963 Brooklyn, New York. She details her Italian-Sicilian family, their language customs, as well as the crazy cast of characters on her beloved block and schoolmates. It references the events and music of the day and focuses on her vivid imagination, dreaming that a brand new pair of red PF Flyer sneakers will give her the ability and superpower of flying. On August 7th, 2023, George O'Brien will be back with us with his novel, Night Mountain. Anyone interested in history of Native American culture and history will enjoy this one. We'll venture back to the year 2050 and listen to Trail Talker Thunder Rock tell stories about the people of Night Mountain. And this is the part of the show where I bring in my co-host, Terry. And it's going to be interesting because both the call board and the call board here, we have two numbers of the same area code. So I'm going to try and guess here. I think this is Terry, but we'll find out in just a second. Terry, is that you?
It is me.
Oh, okay. Well, you got somebody with the same area code as you calling. So,
well, of course.
Of course.
Don't you know you always find friends for me?
I found another connection for you, somebody living in your area code. Well, at least with the area code of your phone number anyway. So how you doing there, girl?
I'm fine, and how are you? I understand you've figured out what was wrong with your kitty cat. I'm so glad to see that.
Yes, unfortunately, we got a diagnosis today of pancreatitis, and hopefully that can be controlled. I've been told it can be. It's just a little bit shocking and disappointment that it was so serious, and it could have been, I was hoping it could have been something less serious, but she's doing fine, and we'll just keep going the way we're going, and just hope for the best. And I know that Facebook friends is out there have offered their thoughts and prayers, and I really do appreciate that. You know, Terry, it means an awful lot, and I know that you've gone through, you are going through some crisis in your family with your husband, so it helps to keep in contact with people out there to gain the support that we need during these rough times.
That is true.
Yes. So I hear you want to talk about book titles. Now, it's interesting because the book title of this show would be Moonshine Messiah, which I found very enticing when I first saw it. I thought, I got to read that. For some reason, it just reached out and grabbed me. What about a book title do you bring to the night's show? What do you want to talk about as far as book titles?
Well, so for me, I hate writing titles. I would rather write six manuscripts than come up with a title. And I was telling somebody, like with Sunflowers Beneath the Snow, I had a working title, and it was just the first character that you met, their first name. And the reason it was the working title, I had to have something to save it in my computer. The problem is that first person that you meet is named Lyxandro. Okay, that's a terrible, terrible title because no one can pronounce it. They can't spell it. They can't remember it. Right? So,
right.
You know, I turned it into the publisher. They came back with a few ideas. I didn't like them. I went with a few ideas. They didn't like them. And this went back and forth for probably 3 or 4 weeks. I figured the book was going to come out as You Name the Book by Terry M. Brown. Like, I had no idea what to do. And so I think it's just really interesting how it isn't as straightforward as you would think, naming a book, because it isn't even necessarily anything specifically said. It might even be a feeling that you get about when you're reading, or it might be something that is important but is only mentioned once. Or, I don't know, it's just, what do you think about naming books?
I think it has to grab you. Now, the historical fiction that I wrote, Poppy's Prison, about my grandfather, who I called Poppy, or Pop for short, it was fairly easy for me to go with that title because he was Poppy, and also he had done time in Sing Sing Prison. He put in 30 years there. So Poppy's Prison sort of pops off your lips, you know. Poppy's Prison sounds
right.
Good, you know.
No, that's excellent. Yeah.
So that worked for me, and I don't think you mentioned Sunflowers Beneath the Snow. Tell us about the process and how that came to be. How did you find that title?
Oh my gosh! Like I said, I went round and round, back and forth, and then finally my editor kind of stopped me and said, "Okay, let's look at themes in the book." and talk about themes in the book. And it was, well, you know, we've got women who persevere. And she said, okay, so we've got these persevering women, and what we see is this unyielding country, and mostly we see how cold it is and how these women are surviving. So then I figured, okay, it's going to be something in the winter. And then I love that first flower that pops up in the springtime, because to me it's kind of like it's telling winter off. Even if it snows on top of that flower, it's letting winter know you're on your last legs. So I started looking at flowers that bloom, you know, in the first of the winter. None of those meant anything to me. And then she said, well, what about sunflowers? That's the national flower. And I said, yeah, but sunflowers don't bloom in the winter. And they're not a first blooming flower. Like, you have to wait until it's warm before they'll start to grow. And then it hit me. But they're waiting. Those seeds are under the ground,
right,
and they're waiting beneath the snow. And then it was like, oh, sunflowers beneath the snow. And it just,
right.
But it was it was really horrible. And then the same thing with An Enemy Like Me. I had all kinds of titles for that, and I wasn't sure what I was going to go with. And when I turned it into my editor at the first, you know, in the very beginning, I still don't have the right title. I had considered, for An Enemy Like Me, I had considered calling it Change. I had considered calling it A Heart Divided. I had tried writing Change in German, except once again, nobody can pronounce it, so it doesn't help anything. And then all of a sudden, An Enemy Like Me, bam, that's what it was supposed to be.
Right.
But I don't find it easy. It's always a long process.
What I like about An Enemy Like Me is it goes directly to the character and immediately brings you into the story. I mean, An Enemy Like Me. In other words, okay, I'm the enemy, but why
right.
am I the enemy? And
right.
now you've already grabbed my attention. And then your first line or your first paragraph of your book in your first chapter should take me further into that character or give me an idea of what's going to come.
Of why? What are we talking about? Right. So I just,
right.
you know, I know that it's so important to have a good title. It's important to have a good title. It's important to have a good cover. And it's important to have a good blurb on the back. And those three things are the main things that people use to determine whether they're going to read your book. And like you said, with the Moonshine Messiah, as soon as you heard that title, you thought, ooh, I want to read that.
Right. Yeah,
and
not
so,
only that, but
know,
since my grandfather, going back to my book, he was involved in the Prohibition days when they did have
exactly.
moonshine. So when I heard that, I thought, wow, got to do that. I don't know where it's going to go, but that really reached out and grabbed me, and I was really happy that I picked that book up because it was a phenomenal book, and we'll hear from Russell here shortly. And the other thing about book titles, from books to movies, you notice that a lot of books that have turned into movies are not always the same title as the book. I can't write off
right.
the top of my head think about it, but I know Stephen King has a few books that were turned into movies that didn't start off that way as books. Stand By Me rings the bell. Remember that movie? Was it Stand By
yeah,
Me the movie?
Yeah.
Or yeah. I
don't
think it was.
Yeah, now you're asking me to do things I can't do.
right. So I can't remember how that worked, but
well,
I don't think it was the same.
Well, there's one
the
out right now. It was called The Man Called Uva. Ova, and nobody can pronounce that. And so as a movie, it's A Man Called Otto.
Yes.
That
yes.
has just
actually,
come out. And so, yeah, they do
actually,
sometimes change the names.
I actually saw that movie, and it's a very good movie, too. Very good movie.
I haven't seen it yet. I tend not to like movies that I've read the book first, but everyone's telling me this one's really good and that I'll enjoy it. So I'm going to go see
uh-huh.
it.
Yeah, it's good. It's really good. So let's get on to the main topic here, guest author intro and interview. And tonight, of course, we have Russell Johnson, who wrote Moonshine Messiah. I want to remind everybody out there, if you're live, you're not dead, of course, but you're listening to us on a live feed, You can call us to talk to Russell or Terry or myself at area code 914-219-0868. That's area code 914-219-0868. And my review of The Moonshine Messiah. Mary Beth Kane is a sheriff in the coal fields of West Virginia, but her position as a law enforcement officer is complicated. She is also the daughter of a lady who runs a hillbilly crime syndicate. And while the sheriff's ties to her family are not strong, they are still there, presenting a whole host of problems for Mary Beth. And also, it's a huge headache for the federal government. Mary Beth's brother, Sawyer, is the cultish leader of an anti-government militia who is hell-bent on causing destruction and mayhem, and one of their first acts is blowing up a federal courthouse. As if Mary Beth doesn't have enough problems, she is also a target of a corruption investigation, and it's headed up by an ex-boyfriend, U.S. Attorney Patrick Connolly. Patrick comes in offering a deal to clear Mary Beth of the charges against her, but the deal swings on a demand that she has to arrest her brother, Sawyer. The offer is refused, but that's before the feds swarm into town to take out Sawyer in a compound that he and his followers are holding down. Sheriff Kane is certainly no pushover, and she comes at you with an attitude and a determination to kick ass, and she makes no apologies. The title immediately captured my interest, and when I opened the book, I witnessed a woman sheriff willing and able to take on a group of mean, ugly, and determined bikers who rolled into her town. I was hooked. Conflict should be one of the most important things that an author works at when sitting down to craft a story. Grade this one an A+ on that note. There is no greater conflict or interest in a story than when someone is pitted against a family member. Hard to put this one down. It has just the right amount of action, dialogue, and intrigue to send it flying up the bestsellers list. Russell Johnson's debut novel is an absolute winner, and the well-rounded and interesting characters within demand an encore. This is a must-read. And now it is our pleasure to welcome Russell Johnson to the Writer's Lounge broadcast, and we'll pull in the door handle here. Hopefully it won't break off in our hands. And in comes Russell here. And Russell, how are you?
Hi, how are you?
I'm very good. And where are you from tonight, besides sitting in our imaginary studio?
Yes, I am in Durham, North Carolina. So that's my part of the 919 area code.
Ah.
Of course you are. So I used to live in Sanford, which is why I have a 919. But I currently live in Calabash on the coast.
Okay, great. Well, good weather there, I hope.
Yeah, well, it's been rainy today, but generally beautiful, yes.
Yes. So we did it again, Terry. We connected you up with somebody that's close by.
I know. You keep doing that to me. So
I do.
So Russell, we keep saying. I know. Russell, we keep saying that this is going to be the Help Terry Make Friends show, because inevitably I have a connection with just about everybody that is on the show, and Tom doesn't know it beforehand.
When my parents are in Leland, so they're pretty close to you out there.
Oh, my goodness. That's the same county. Isn't that crazy? Yeah. See, you did it again, Tom.
I did. I didn't even realize I did it this time. I would have probably said something to you before we brought you on the show tonight. But anyways, Russell, tell us more about you, what you do, and why did you decide to sit down and write The Moonshine Messiah?
Well, I am a lawyer. It's my day job. And I'm married, have two kids. And years ago, it was probably about 13 years ago now, the stress of being a lawyer had kind of gotten to me to the point that I decided I needed some escapism. And I had always wanted to be a writer, but I had always kind of put that on the back burner. And it was right about the time that, things in my lawyer life were just getting really stressful, and my family life was getting more stressful. We were about to have our second child. That I just, kind of told myself, if I don't write a book before the second child is born, then I'm just afraid I'm never going to do it. And so I, got out my calendar and I count out 100 days and I got up at 4:30 every morning and wrote 1,000 words before I went to work every day. And, you know, at the end of that, I had a book that was absolutely terrible. But I knew at that point that I could do it, you know, at least like, you know, physically compile, you know, that number of words. And the more important thing is I caught the bug. And so, you know, like I knew at that point being a writer is really what I want to do. And so I've been at it for a long time. You know, I'd written a novel that I spent like 5 years on and never got any traction with it. And then I decided to go and focus on short stories for a while, which I did, you know, for a number of years. And then this was kind of the second novel that I wrote after I finally gave up on that first one. And got an agent right away, and he spent 2 years, I'm not sure what he was doing, and then I got another agent, and then another agent, and so, you know, it kind of never sold to the big publishers, but then I had sent out on my own to a bunch of smaller publishers, and got it published just here recently with Shotgun Honey.
Well, I've got to say that I've got to say that this one is one of the best I've read, and it being your first novel, that says a lot. And believe me, over the course of, what is it now, almost 12 years doing the show, I've had on a handful of authors who have gone on to do very well in their writing careers. And I would put down a bet that the same thing is going to happen to you. I don't know if you continue lawyering, if you're going to be able to hang on to that ride of success as a writer, but we'll see what happens. But you certainly delivered greatly with this novel, and I was really excited to read it. And I was glued right to the pages. And I don't say that all about everybody that I've read, but as pointed out in a review, Russell, conflict is very important to a good story. What do you first focus on when sitting down to write a story?
You know, I think I'm probably a plot first writer. You know, I think a lot about character, but I do sort of start with the external plot. And I always kind of think of, you know, in terms of, there needs to be, at least for me, there needs to be an external plot and then sort of an internal plot for your main character, you know, and hopefully you can kind of find a way that both reach their climax at sort of the same point. So I like it where there's sort of like character growth or something that has to happen to unlock, you know, or to solve the external plot. And so, I would definitely say I'm a plot first person, but I think the character is a very close second for me in terms right. of how I think about story.
Yeah, I know, Terry, we discussed this with other writers, but are you an outline guy or no, or do you just go by the seat of your pants?
You know, I outline a little bit in my head. Like I'll usually know, you know, some of the major milestones in the story. You know, I know what the twist is. I usually know the ending, the beginning, you know, maybe another little thing that happens in there. But then I pretty much kind of make it up as I go and how I get from, you know, A to B to C. And I very rarely ever write things down. And if I do, I almost never go back to look at it. You know, sometimes it's just that process of getting it out on your head is helpful. I'm probably more on the pantser end of the spectrum, I would say.
Right. Yeah, there he is too.
So am I. Yeah. Yeah, I have a hard time with outlines. I write an outline, and then my characters refuse to follow. So,
Terry, you get the next question there.
Yeah.
Lady.
So you're an attorney, which I think is really cool. Do you see those experiences being a lawyer influencing you going forward as a writer? And did they influence the creation of any of the characters in your current book, The Moonshine Messiah?
Well, I definitely think they'll influence things going forward. I've written a legal thriller that's in relation to this that I've got an agent who's pitching right now. And, you know, I tend to get a lot of material from my day job, you know, that comes up with good ideas for stories. And in this one, you know, certainly the Patrick Connelly character and the Alexander Pomfrey, sort of the country lawyer, I mean, those were both very much influenced by, you know, my experiences as an attorney.
Mm-hmm.
Great. How much research, if any, did you do in writing this book, and do you enjoy it?
So, you know, not a whole lot of research. I mean, I'm from West Virginia originally, and my parents are now in Leland. They're from coal country, and so I kind of grew up, you know, with stories of what coal towns were like. And my wife is from southern West Virginia, and a lot of my family are. And so, you know, a lot of my research has come from, you know, just being in this area quite a bit and hearing lots of stories and things like that. So, you know, most of my research tends to just be enough of, like, Google and Wikipedia to make it sound like I have some idea what I'm talking about.
And I imagine in your career as a lawyer, you probably do quite a bit of research when you're working on your cases. Is that correct?
Yeah, you certainly do. You know, a lot of case law research. And so there was a little bit of that here too. You know, since I'm not a West Virginia lawyer, I check out West Virginia statutes and things like that from time to time. But, you know, I think I'm mindful of kind of the Stephen King advice he has in On Writing of, you know, like, as rare as I think sometimes we can really fall in love with our research and start, you know, boring our readers with it. And so it's like, it's kind of a judgment call, and just, you need enough there to have the texture and realism, but not so much that you start turning it into a textbook, which as a lawyer, I'm apt to do. So I'm always trying not to overdo it with that.
Well, what type of law do you practice?
So now I do mostly workers' comp. I was kind of a bigger firm corporate litigator for about 11 years, and that was the job I was getting really burned out with when I started writing. And at some point, I decided to leave there and join my best friend from law school, who had his own firm where we primarily represent Latino immigrants. And so a lot of Latino folks tend to pop up in my stories because those are the people that I'm working with on a daily basis. And so immigration is one of our big practice areas. You know, we do some criminal and family law and all those things. But my main area is representing folks have been injured. So it's, you know, it's a lot of construction workers and things who've had bad injuries, and a lot of them have not been treated very well. So it's kind of nice because you're always sort of like David against Goliath in a way. And
I imagine there's a lot of grist for the mill there for future stories that you might want to write. I would think that your imagination would be cued into some of those cases that you work on. But anyway, Terry, you have the next question.
Yes. So there are some hints in your book that relate to current events, you know, in today's world. Is there a certain message or moral to the story that you hope readers take away after reading the book?
Oh, let's see. Well, you know, I think that I think that a lot of the followers of Sawyer and just a lot of the people in this small town, West Virginia in general, are people who are kind of grieving the loss of an era that has kind of had its day and gone by, you know. So the loss of coal jobs is obviously a big issue for people in the book and in this region, and just kind of the loss of the society and the culture that was part of it. And I do think that there are those who capitalize on that sort of sense of grievance who are kind of charlatans. And so Sawyer, I think, is certainly one of those. Who he's very charismatic and he's great at riling people up. But at the end of the day, what he's really motivated by is just his own, you know, maniacal desires, and not really the people that he's trying to represent or that he purports to represent. And then at the same time, you've got people like Mary Beth who really just aren't political, you know, at all. Like, she just really wants to take care of the people of her county. And so I think, you know, you can draw your own connections to who those people might be. be in today's society, but I guess that's sort of my message, if there is one.
That certainly is, seems to be the case these days where, you know, people will pick up on something that an author writes and sort of try to inject it into current events. But, you know, this book, I think, probably could have been written many years ago because, you know, there are people like that out there. And, you know, just because of, you know, current events like 9/11 and also what happened on January 6th, kind of bring it to the forefront when authors write stories. And I think, you know, I really enjoyed that part of it. I enjoyed that there was the relationship between sister and brother, and then the sister your main character and her mother was quite interesting also. And, you know, the conflict, of course, is what we, what I picked up on that brought your story up the scales to, you know, a must read. Do you find that conflict is something that you spend a lot of time, when we get back to when you're plotting your story, was there a lot of conflict there in figuring out where you were going to go, or did you focus on conflict, or did that just kind of happen?
I think that's sort of like the initial idea that I have to have to start a story. Like I need to kind of know what the conflict is. I usually have some kind of twist, you know, around page 200 or so. And so if I don't have those to begin with, I can't really get a story off the ground. And then secondarily, I think sort of, you know, what are the personal conflicts that are involved? And if you can sort of find some that sort of seem like they can dance together thematically, then that's when I feel like I've got a story that I can really stretch out to a novel length, you know, work.
Yeah. Terry, when you wrote your books, I wanted to ask you this before, but did you spend a lot of time on conflict, or is that something that just worked for you?
I think it just kind of comes in. I recognize that characters don't do any growing if there isn't conflict to make them do that. And I'm really very character driven. And so I think the conflict, it's almost like, okay, we resolved that thing and they grew in this way, but I still need them to grow over here. Now what has to happen? So it's almost like I go from conflict to allow my characters to grow. But I don't know that I sat down and thought about it first. It just kind of happens naturally. But that's the way I write. I don't tend to put anything down. Sometimes I have a starting point, and sometimes I have an ending point, but I don't usually have both.
Interesting, very interesting. So, Russell, where do you prefer to go when you write, and is there anything you do to get into the mood to write? Some of us listen to music. Some of us just meditate. What do you do to get into the mood? I suppose it's your day job, days as a lawyer, probably, you know, have to put that all aside and get into the mood of being a writer.
Yeah, I tend to be an early morning writer. You know, I think what works best for me is when I can get up before everyone else is up, and I've got an hour or two of quiet and some coffee, and it's kind of nice because you haven't like totally roused yourself completely out of that dream state with the imagination sometimes. You know, I used to kind of pound away late at night. I don't really do that so much anymore. As I'm getting older, I can't stay awake that late. and weekend, I make weekends count. You know, I'm not someone who necessarily writes every day anymore. But when I've kind of got the momentum going, I like to really push, you know, and try to keep it flowing as much as I can. So I kind of write more in spurts and things now than just like, you know, a chapter a day or you know, so many words a day like I used to.
I'm sorry, did you say where do you go to write?
So, you know, in terms of place, it doesn't really matter so much to me. Like a lot of times I'll just sit in a chair with my laptop on my lap. You know, that's probably the place where I do most of it. You know, I'll occasionally go to coffee shops and sit there and do that. But I'm pretty flexible with all that. I've even gotten to the point where I use Google Docs a lot. And sometimes if I've got an idea that hits me, I'll pull out the phone and start, you know, punching away on the phone. And, you know, you always have to do a lot of editing on that. But it's kind of good to get the idea down while it's fresh in your head.
Right. I'm the type of person I have to go in my office here to write. I can't really do it anywhere else. I do have a laptop. I could go somewhere else, but for me, it's got to be in my office. I know Terry is sort of the actual flip opposite of that. You like to go out somewhere, right, Terry?
I like to be anywhere but my office.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, when I'm in my office, I can do research in my office. I can do nonfiction writing for, you know, small businesses in my office. But if I'm going to be writing fiction, I'd like to be somewhere where real life isn't stopping me. I think that's part of being a mom and a wife. If I'm in my office and I hear the buzzer on the dryer, I feel compelled to get up and go check the dryer. And if I hear the dog bark, I feel compelled to go let the dog out. And, you know, I glance at the time and it's like, oh, I probably should go and, you know, thaw out whatever that is so we can have dinner. Whereas if I'm somewhere other than here at home, none of those things are bothering me, and then I can go ahead and write. So, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Your characters, Russell, are very well developed. And I'm just wondering, is there anybody in your life that you pattern these characters after? Especially, I really liked the mother. I thought she was really, really cool. Did you pattern her after anybody that you know personally?
Not especially. You know, I think she's maybe a little bit inspired by the Mags Bennett character in the Justified series. I'm a big Elmore Leonard fan, and you know, Justified is certainly a big influence on me. The Raylan Givens character. I kind of imagined this notion sort of started with the idea of imagining like what a female Mary or Raylan Givens would be. That's sort of how Mary Beth Kane started out. And so, you know, with the mother, the Mamie character, I just, to me, the most interesting thing with her is, I think one of the big themes of Mary Beth's life is, am I the same as my mother, or am I going to become my mother, who she sees as kind of a sociopath? But from her own self point of view, I think it's probably someone who, you know, did what she had to do and used the opportunities and skills that were available to her to accomplish her goals. And so, and Mary Beth certainly has a lot of similar traits and things of that nature. And so I kind of imagine her as just sort of like a harder edged, older, you know, version from a different era of Mary Beth. And so that's mostly where she came from.
Yeah, I would love to meet her. she really did it for me for some reason. I really liked her. Russell, what would be your definition of being successful as a writer?
So that's a good question. I'm rarely satisfied with anything for very long. I've been very happy to get into print, and it's really neat that people who I don't know and I'm not related to are reading the book and, you know, sending me little messages about it. So, I feel like this has been a successful step in a career. I'd like to continue taking other steps. I think to me, like, the dream would be to write something that got theatrically produced, you know, as a movie or a series or something like that. I don't know that I would ever quit my day job, but to be successful enough at writing where that was a realistic option, you know, would be great. So I don't know that any of those things are really attainable. I mean, those are sort of like the writer's equivalent of winning the lottery, but those are certainly, if I got to just pick, that's probably how I would define success.
Right. You ever read John Grisham?
Oh, yeah. I grew up on John Grisham. In fact, I probably became a lawyer because of John Grisham. I love Grisham books, especially in high school.
Yeah, I think your style is somewhat follows that path of John Grisham. Another reason why I like the book, because I really do like John Grisham novels myself. Terry, you get the next question.
Yeah, so how has the publishing, editing, marketing, those kinds of things gone with your book? And are there any things that you would do differently now that it's out?
So there's really nothing I would do differently at this point. I mean, I'm very happy with the publisher that I ended up with. You know, Shotgun Honey, one, they're it's based out of West Virginia, which I think is nice and appropriate for this novel. But they're it's a publisher I've been aware of for a long time because they're you know, they started, I want to say, like 2011, 2012 as kind of an e-zine publishing flash fiction. And so, mm-hmm. you know, if you're kind of in the indie crime short story world, I think, you know, you probably have heard of Shotgun Honey because it's where a lot of people sort of started learning their craft and they're tough, you know, to get published there. They certainly rejected me a number of times with flash fiction pieces. And the guy who runs it and has continued it there, Ron Earl Phillips, I really think is just the best cover designer out there. You know, he does great covers. And so, you know, I love the cover that he did. You know, I think they've got kind of just a cool, you know, reputation and ethos. So that's all great. You know, publishing with a small publisher and honestly, even with some bigger publishers these days, you know, writers really have to do the lion's share of the
all
marketing
of
themselves.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Really
pretty
all
much
of it.
All of
so,
it. Yep.
Yeah. And so, you know, I'm no expert on that. You know, my wife was a advertising major and I have a sister who works in digital marketing. So they've been able to help me, you know, with getting a good website, and I do, you know, some Facebook kind of ads and, you know, I've been lucky to get, you know, several podcast interviews and a really great feature in the Charleston, West Virginia Daily Mail, which is really nice. But, you know, it's all just kind of trial and error, you know, just keep punching away and hope that it breaks through, you know, to some extent.
Yeah. Terry and I talked about, in Writer's Topics, we talked about titles. And Moonshine Messiah, as I had said, that it immediately grabbed me. How long did it take you to come up with that title?
So I usually have to have a title before I start writing. It often will change, but I kind of have to have that notion because I like to have it, you know, meet like the theme of the story. And this one, the initial title was The Mayberry Messiah, in part because, you know, it's sort of about, like, you know, the loss of this idealized notion of the past, which Mayberry sort of typifies. And I tried to put a lot of little West Virginia Easter eggs, and one of them is about Don Knotts, you know, who played Barney Fife, and
yes.
There's a little mm-hmm. discussion about Mayberry in there. And a writer friend of mine in a critique group, Eric Pruitt, he's the one who recommended changing it to Moonshine Messiah, which I love because it's kind of the immediate sort of Appalachian culture connotation there with moonshine. And so that's where that came about.
And there's a segment in the story where the moonshine is passed around, and I like the idea it was in a jar, and I believe they took a sip, and that's all you could do is just take a little sip, and it burned on the way down. So I appreciated that, although I've never had moonshine, but I can imagine it's a lot like the way you described it.
Yeah, definitely some strong stuff. I think I was maybe 6 years old the first time I had moonshine, and I was like running around playing with my cousins, and I thought there was a glass of water sitting on the table, and chugged it down, and realized very quickly it was not water.
Oh my goodness!
Oh wow!
Ouch.
Nothing tastes worse than anything that you think is water and it's not.
Yeah. Oh my goodness. Oh my gosh. Reviews. How do you handle the good ones and the bad ones? We talk a lot about that on the Writer's Lounge.
So I'm a little surprised. I thought I would really obsess over reviews. You know, like I used to, you know, when I get a short story published, would really like search, you know, for the Amazon reviews, see if I was mentioned and things. I've been very pleased with ones that have come out. But for the most part, I'm really just kind of looking to make sure, you know, like to see if I'm getting reviews. I've really tried not to read them too closely or obsess about them. You know, I got my first like one star review. And so I kind of took that as a badge of honor, you know, like I finally got
yes.
to the point where someone hated me enough to put a one-star review. And so after being ignored for so long, I'll take it. But for the most part,
yeah.
It's been great. People have been very kind.
Terry can relate. I don't think I've got a one-star review yet, so I'm still flying high, although I've only gotten maybe seven
I got
reviews.
A two-star the other day. I got a two-star the other day, and it was not pretty. And then I just thought, well, it's okay. Not everybody has to like my book, and I just moved on.
Right. Very good. Yeah. Now, we were talking about being successful as a writer. I would say the definition of being successful is when you can take the good and the bad reviews and just toss them and have it not bother you at all. That's the success that I'm looking for, because it bothers me when I get a bad one, and it puts me on cloud nine when I get a good one. So that's, I don't know. That's interesting. The reviews are always interesting to talk about here on the Writer's Lounge. So do you intend to continue writing stories with the same characters? And who is your favorite and least character in Moonshine Messiah? We talked a little bit about characters a few minutes ago.
So I do intend to write more with these characters. I've already written a sequel to this one that I'm in sort of the final stages of editing. And I've got an idea for a third one, which I would plan to be the last. You know, I want to wrap it up as kind of a trilogy. And as far as my favorite character, you know, I love Izzy, you know, her little sidekick. I like the mom. She's a lot of fun. Sawyer, I think it's great because sometimes, you know, the villains give you a chance to, like, say some things, you know, you wouldn't be allowed to say except through a character. But I have to say, Mary Beth is my favorite. You know, I think Mary Beth, she's a very brave person. She's a complicated, flawed person for sure. But I think, you know, under her very tough exterior, she's got a heart of gold. And so she is my favorite.
I do have a question that just came to mind. Would you defend Sawyer if he came to you as needing a lawyer, if you were a criminal defense attorney?
Well, so I've done just a little bit of criminal defense. Luckily, I would, in real life, I'd be able to punt on that as not being qualified to do it. That's tough. Probably not. You know, I've been fortunate to, for the most part, to be able to kind of not take cases I didn't want to take. And that's one, you know, if the guy was about to kill all these people, you know, who are my people. I as much as I am a heartless, soulless lawyer, I think I'd probably turn that one down.
Yeah. I had a friend of mine that became a prosecutor. He was both prosecutor and defense attorney here in Onondaga County, Bob Mascari. I don't know if he's still around. I know he's still around, but I don't think he tunes into this show at all. But I had asked him one time if he would defend somebody that he knew committed a crime or murder, and he said he would, because his quick answer was because he wants to make sure that he gets a fair trial. I think that if I was a lawyer in that position and nobody wanted to defend Sawyer, I think I might step in just so that I feel that he would get a fair trial. So I don't know. That's just my take on it.
Yeah, and that's, you know, that's the motto, you know, I think for a lot of criminal defense lawyers. And I certainly, I've certainly represented people who I thought were wrong, and that doesn't bother me so much. But if I have a sort of a personal hang up with it where I think it would affect my representation, then that's something where I think it's pretty easy to say no to.
Uh-huh. Terry, you got the next question.
Yes. So besides being an author and being a cold-hearted lawyer, what do you like to do in your free time?
So I've started learning guitar. I've been at for about 2 years now, taking lessons, and I'm not musical at all. I've got no natural musical ability, but I am very obsessive you know, I have stick-to-itiveness, and so I've been working at that lately. That's my latest little obsession.
Wonderful. Wonderful.
Yeah, that's great. I wish I had musical ambitions. I really don't, because I really am not good in that area. But Do you think, Russell, or people in general, read enough, and where do you see the future of books in, say, 50 years from now?
So I don't think people read enough books. I mean, I think we read all the time on our phones, you know, tweets and things like that. Future of books. I'm optimistic that books are going to be here for a long time still. You know, I think people have called for the doom of books, you know, a number of times, and they've managed to endure. I think, you know, we may see more things like the novella come back, maybe somewhat of a resurgence of short stories, just because I don't know if people have as much attention span for the really long books. I know anything over 400 pages I tend to shy away from, even as a reader and writer. But the book itself, no, I think that as our world gets more and more kind of chaotic with so much noise and barrage of information, that, you know, it's kind of like how like the long form podcast has become a thing now. You know, people want a chance to like really drill down on something and focus on it and give it attention. And I think, you know, that's one of the great things that the books give us, you know, that you can't really find a lot of other places.
Right. I have to say that I would disagree personally myself. I like a long read. I shy away from the short stories. I don't know, Terry, how do you deal with that?
I don't have a lot of time. So if a book is over 400 pages, I either get it on audio where when I'm doing a lot of the driving that I have to do, I can be listening to it. And it's a book that I'm going to have to listen to over a period of time because I'm never going to have the time to sit and listen to that whole thing. Or I tend to shy away from it just because I don't have the time. I like a good short story. I think my problem with a short story is it's a little too short for me. So I like maybe a short story collection where there's several stories that kind of have the same theme that keep me interested. I've just started dabbling in short stories myself. I love flash fiction. And so I'm kind of expanding that flash fiction idea into some short stories. So I may have to talk with Russell later and find out, you know, what he learned about the craft.
Great. And so, Russell, we're getting down to be about, I think we got about 7 minutes left here, and this is what we say is your Oscar moment. I would like to ask you if you would like to thank anybody out there, and, you know, you got it. It's your floor is yours.
Yeah. Yeah, well, so I'd like to thank my writer friends. I've been very lucky to be in two great critique groups. The first one that I was in, you know, it was really instrumental in writing the Moonshine Messiah when I was working on the first draft, because it's a female protagonist, and it was a group of all women who were able to give me, you know, feedback on, you know, the female perspective. And so that group had Lynn Fairchild Hawks, who writes kind of like edgy YA. She has a book that just came out called Nerves of Steel. She also has a book called Wendy Redbird, How Wendy Redbird Dancing Survived the Dark Ages of Knot. Long title there. Stephanie Moore, who's a great writer. She's a screenwriter. She actually wrote the screenplay. Gosh, I'm going to blank on the name now, but it was a movie with Lindsay Lohan and Tyra Banks, where Tyra Banks is like a Barbie doll that comes to life. And she writes kind of like romantic comedy stuff. Another lady named Amanda Gladden-Kramer, who is a lawyer in California, who is a really, really, really super talented writer, but just like is so hard on herself, she never finishes anything because she can't turn her inner critic off enough to complete it. And then I'm in a really great writers group now that I've worked with in revising things. And it tends to be more crime writers. My friend Eric Pruitt, who has a new novel that's out called Something Bad Wrong. Grant Heatherton has had two novels. He goes by J.G. Heatherton, and he's had two novels in kind of his Laura Chambers series, started with Last Girl Gone and then What Lies Beneath. My friend Scott Blackburn, who just had his debut come out last year, called It Dies With You. It's kind of great Southern fiction, kind of Southern noir. And then another writer named J.M. Rosinski, whose book Forest of Giant Oaks came out this year. it's really neat. It's sort of like a time travel book of like if the framers of the Constitution were brought into modern day. It's
got well, what's like the name of that again? What's the name of that again?
A Forest of Giant Oaks.
Oh, I've got to look
at apparently that is a quote from maybe Lincoln or is one of the founders. I'm not sure which one, but yeah, it is very different, very, very interesting concept. And then another writer named Philip Kimbrough is in that group, and he's another one who's a really great writer but just can't turn his inner critic off enough to get across the goal line and finish something. So he's still working on that. And then a new writer just joined us now named Casey Stedman, who's working on some really promising stuff and doing some great short stories. So that's my Oscar speech.
Very good. And where can listeners contact you?
So I have a website that is RussellWJohnson.com. And I would say you got to put the W in there because if you don't, if you just Google Russell Johnson, you'll get the professor from Gilligan's Island. And that's not me. And I'm on Twitter at @RWJESQ. I always tell people it's a joke. I used to tell my wife that if when I became a lawyer, she was going to have to call me Esquire, which of course she never did. And so that's, you know, she'll do that mockingly sometimes. And I'm on Facebook, so Russell W. Johnson on Facebook.
Great. Russell, it's been a pleasure. We wish you great success with your upcoming books, and you know that I will be reading the next installment of Moonshine Messiah. I'm really looking forward to it. Thank you for being on the Writer's Lounge tonight.
Thank you so much for having me. Very much enjoyed it.
Yeah, take care now. And there goes another one, Terry, that is, show number 140. I can't believe that we're approaching 12 years here in the Writer's Lounge, and I'm looking forward to doing 12 more years if I'm still around and not in diapers by that time. So, we never know what tomorrow's going to bring. And
you never know, but I have a feeling that you're going to be around writing stories for a long time.
If I'm not writing stories, I'll be reading and reviewing. But, I don't do as many stories as you do, dear, but my hat's off to you. I don't know how you do it. It's amazing. It takes me working on one novel that's taken me over 11 years, and it's still not complete. And the other one, of course, Poppy's Prison, was done quickly within, I don't know, I think a year and a half. But you still have that beat. So,
what's interesting, I think part of that's my personality. If I worked on something for 11 years, I would be so bored. There's no way. Like, if I can't get it done pretty quickly, I don't have a very long attention span. I like things that are fast and furious, and let's get in there and get out.
Right.
So I think that's why I call myself a binge pantster. I sit down and I binge write until the story is out of my system, and then it's like, phew, that's done. Now I can go do something else. That's another reason why I like the short story and the flash fiction, because it's quick. You know, like I can just sit down and get the story idea out. Now, the editing still takes a lot of time, and there's wordsmithing and all of that stuff, but getting the beginning, the middle, and the end out of my head in flash fiction and short stories is kind of fun because of how quickly it happens.
Right. And so it was great hearing from Russell Johnson, who wrote Moonshine Messiah. I really enjoyed it, and I look forward to reading more from him. And that would be the final chapter tonight. And next time in 2 weeks, I'm not sure if you're going to be here in 2 weeks. Are you going to be here in 2 weeks?
So we're going to have to play it by ear. Bruce has to go to Duke that day. And so it will depend a whole lot on how quickly we get in and out of there. So I will keep you up to date.
Very good.
I hope to be there. I'd really love to be there for the next book.
Tomasina DiCrescenzo wrote Two Left Feet, and that book is the voice of an 11-year-old girl living in 1963, Brooklyn, New York. She details her Italian-Sicilian family, their language, customs, as well as a crazy cast of characters on her beloved block and Schoolmates. So until then, Terry and I will see you next time on the Writer's Lounge, where we encourage writers and readers to keep the pen in the eyes to the page and to let the story begin. Enjoy yourselves and be well, and good night.
If they asked me, I could write a book about the way you walk and whisper and look. I could write a preface on how we met, so the world would never forget. And the simple secret of the plot, it's just to tell you that I love you a lot. Then the world discovers, as my book ends, how to make